Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. This is your host Rekha Narolbat, and today I am talking to Chara Ranganath, professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Davis. He published his book, Why We Remember, in February 2024, so just 2 months ago, and it became immediately a bestseller. So congratulations, and thanks a lot for coming to NBM.
Thank you very much for having me.
Charan, can you please start with introducing yourself?
Yes, my name is Charan Ranganath, and I'm a professor at the Center for Neuroscience and the Department of Psychology at UC Davis and the director of the Dynamic Memory Lab.
Great, and you are now also bestseller author of a popular science book. What motivated you to write such a book?
I've been working on memory research for a long time, over almost 30 years, which is, every time I say that, it still scares me. But a lot of our everyday work is really just talking to other memory researchers. And I especially felt like it was important to explain what it is that we know about memory from the scientific perspective to people who are smart and curious but don't necessarily know about the topic. I think a lot of my daily life is engaging in debates and arguments sometimes it's very productive about areas of disagreement, but there's so many findings that we have that are so important that everyone agrees upon. And I don't think that information had gotten out to the public. And so it was very important for me to write this book to get a chance to explain it to people and see how the science of memory can actually be put to use to inform and improve people's lives.
That sounds like a great reason. Can you mention some of these concepts that everybody or most of the researchers agree on, but aren't really widespread knowledge outside the neuroscience community?
I think one of the biggest ideas that people don't appreciate is that if you look at studies of forgetting, there's almost universal agreement that most of the details that we experience will be forgotten. And when I say they'll be forgotten, I don't mean the forgotten in 10 years. I mean within 24 to 48 hours. And so I think many people expect that in an ideal world, we should have perfect memory for everything. And people tend to believe that most of what they experience will be remembered. And in fact, that's just an incorrect assumption. And so that's why I titled the book, Why We Remember, because I think people often ask me, why am I so forgetful? But if most of what we experience is forgotten, then the question is, what actually makes the events that we remember so special? What's the purpose of memory? Why do we remember anything in the first place? Because that's not the default. It's not that we can guarantee that everything will be remembered. I think that's probably the biggest one. And then I think the other related idea is that people think of memory as a strict replay of the past, as opposed to something that's much more generative and constructive and even imagined. And that was another big message I wanted to get across in the book, is that memory is largely based on this structure where we can impose our perspective and our imagination to fill in the blanks in our memories. And then when we revisit those memories, we alter them. And so the memories that we have, as I say, are built on shifting sands. Every time we recall a memory, they're changing. And so this idea of this pristine, perfect record of the past is just not accurate.
So can we say that two misconceptions are how much we are able to remember, and the second one is how well we are able to remember it actually?
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's the short answer to your question, yes.
Well, I found it quite thought-provoking how you elaborated this concept in greater length in your book. And one quote which I find interesting is, I like to think of memory as less like a photograph and more like a painting. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I wrote that because people often either say, well, memories are true or they're false. And I think both ideas are dangerous in some ways, because if you assume everything that people remember are true, you find that, in fact, many people have been thrown into prison because of somebody's incorrect memory for something where they were confidently remembering something that never happened. On the other hand, if you assume that memory is completely false, you can often reject people's real recollections of things that happened, and that's not what you want either. And so rather than getting caught in this thing of true or false, I wanted to change people's understanding, where if you see memory as like a painting, the idea is that sometimes if I paint a picture, that picture that I paint is going to have some details that are very true to the subject. Like, let's say if I painted a picture of you, I might have black hair in the picture based on what I can see in this camera. And so I might have certain features like that. But on the other hand, I might have some features that are incorrectly drawn, and sometimes things that weren't even in the picture. I might omit things from the picture that were there. And I might also just include some features that are neither really here nor there, but just reflecting the perspective that I have and reflecting my own beliefs and thoughts and artistic signature. And I think memory is like that too. Just like you could revisit a painting and repaint certain parts and change the painting, when we revisit a memory, we can also revisit those artistic creations that we've made.
It's intriguing to think about memory like an artistic creation. And one thing you explained in this part is the connection between memory and creativity. And you have a unique perspective on it also as a musician. So can you talk about that a little bit?
One of the most surprising findings, I think, to come out of the neuroscience of memory has been this idea that when people imagine an event that never took place, the activity that you see in the brain looks very much like what happens when people remember something that did happen to them. And so this actually goes back to an old idea that was proposed by a scientist named Frederick Bartlett. And Bartlett proposed that when we remember the past, we do get some bits and pieces of what happened, but then we use those bits and pieces as fodder to imagine the past. So we don't replay the past, but rather we imagine how the past could have been based on the little bits that we recall. And one of the fascinating findings that has come up is that Bartlett was also right, and a few other researchers were very far ahead of the curve in this, in saying that it goes in the forward direction too, that when we imagine new things, they're not being created out of the blue. They're actually being synthesized from experiences that we've had. They're synthesized from the knowledge that we have about our world, which is called semantic memory, and unique experiences that you and I have had in the real world throughout our lifetime, just singular events, somebody who you just ran into at a party and just had a conversation with, or some book that you happened to read because it was recommended online in a Facebook group or something like that. And those little bits and pieces are what make your imagination unique. And when you look at people with brain damage and memory disorders, they often have a very impoverished imagination because they don't seem to have that capability of synthesizing the past in new ways that you can imagine new creations.
If we think about memory so much intertwined with other cognitive abilities, then it's also not a surprise what your book said, that sometimes when people seem to have exceptionally good memories, what's going on is actually something different. And you mentioned LeBron James as an example for this. Can you talk about why you think he can remember these games so well?
Yes, and in fact, this is something that I've found in many, many areas of expertise. So one of the first areas where researchers started to understand how important expertise is in memory was done on chess experts. So if you look at a grandmaster in chess, they can often, if you just show them a bunch of pieces of chess pieces on a board, they can memorize it very, very quickly and reproduce it from scratch. But a novice will have no ability to do this. And likewise, if you look at someone like LeBron James, who's has the NBA scoring record, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, he has this incredible ability to recollect in detail, play by play, every game that he's ever done. And I was talking to someone else who was saying that you could see the same thing in race car drivers, that a race car driver can hear the sound of an engine and say, ah, this was in this particular turn on this particular track, just based on hearing it. And in fact, that they can even drive the track blindfolded based on their memory for these tracks. So in many, many different areas, whether it's a bird watcher or a chess expert or a race car driver or a basketball player, people seem to have this enormous capability to remember things in their area of expertise. And we think the reason is because people who are experts are able to use their knowledge to encode memories more efficiently. That is, expertise changes the way you look at the world. And they're picking out the bits and pieces of information that are the most important to be able to remember. And they have a lot of knowledge about how events play out, let's say in a basketball game. And so they can use that knowledge in real time to take what's happening in the moment and be able to project where things are going to go in the future, whether it's a chess player thinking four moves out or a basketball player seeing how play is going to unfold just based on scanning the court at a given moment.
Yes, that's a pattern indeed, which appears in many fields. And one of the intriguing parts of the finding about chess grandmasters was that they don't seem to have an exceptional memory in other areas. And in fact, if they need to memorize a position, which can't really happen during a normal chess game, then they aren't especially good at it. But if you show them a real position, their skills are amazing. And this actually led to the importance, to recognizing the importance of a concept that you also talk a lot about in your book, which is schema. Can you introduce that?
Yes, yeah. So experts really exploit schemas because what a schema is basically a ability to have kind of a template in your head, a basic idea of the structure of the way things work. What I mean by that is, for instance, if I even just say the word wedding, when you think of a wedding, you can think of all the different stages that happen during a wedding. There might be, depending on your traditions and your cultures, there might be a bride and groom walking down the aisle and then a ring being put on, and then there's going to be a reception and cake and so forth. And so these are the sequences of events that we have in our head. But what's beautiful about schemas is you can apply those schemas to events that have never taken place and generate a whole prediction about what things are going to happen. And why that's so important is when you go to a wedding, you don't have to form a memory for everything that happened because you already have in your head most of what's going to happen during a wedding. And if you know the people who are getting married, you have a lot of information about them. And so all you need to do is encode the information that's unique to this particular moment. And that's what you have to focus on for memory. And likewise, a chess expert has in their head a massive mental library of positions of pieces on a board and where a expert player will go with moves in the future based on where the pieces are in the present. And so that allows them to reduce the amount of information they would have to memorize. So a person who is a novice might actually just have to look at every square on the board and every piece and try to memorize all those mappings. But to a chess expert, they have a schema that they can use and pull out and say, all of this pattern I'm seeing is basically one thing. I've seen this one thing before. And arguably, we all have schemas that allow us to be experts at something or another, whether it's being able to understand particular classes of events like weddings or, you know, things that we might be interested in like music or cars or birds or whatever. And these are just natural human abilities that we have to memorize more, not by being able to capture every little bit and piece of our experience, but really to memorize more by, or to remember more, I should say, by memorizing less, and to use the schema as a way to reduce what we need.
It's a cool way of putting this, remember more by memorizing less. And is it fair to say that our knowledge in the area greatly influences how much we remember about a specific event or thing?
That's right. So if you have knowledge, you can also find meaning in what you're trying to remember. And that gives you a very important capability, which is the ability to link what you're trying to memorize to information that you already know. And so as a result, now this new memory is anchored into a lot of knowledge that you already have. That's why if you flip it around and you look at some of the hardest things that we have to remember, they tend to be things that are quite meaningless, like a phone number or a password for a computer that's like where somebody just gives you like a auto-generated password that's very complicated, or of course, like memorizing names and faces, because there's nothing about a name that goes with a face. There's no meaning to it. But sometimes you can find that people can even remember these arbitrary things like a name of somebody that you're meeting. If you know something about their biography, if you know something about what they do for a living and how they might be linked to you through a common friend or relative. And so it just shows how powerful it is to be able to find meaning in whatever it is you're trying to memorize.
Besides your knowledge in the field, so to say, it seems that your general cognitive abilities are also greatly influence your memory skills, so to say. So in the book, you also describe your earlier clinical work where you met a lot of patients who had complaints about memory, and often it turned out to be another problem in the background.
In much of my clinical work, I found that I was testing people who had problems with memory, but it wasn't that they didn't have a capability to form new memories. It's that they had problems being able to focus on what they needed to remember. And so these difficulties were related to problems in the functioning of an area of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is a massive area in the human brain. It's very important for being able to say, based on my goal, this is the information that's relevant, and to block out the information that's not relevant to you at any given time. And the prefrontal cortex is very important because if there are things that I'm trying to remember, like somebody's name, it allows me to say, hey, this is a very important thing. I better pay attention to this name. And maybe I should use a strategy to try to memorize that name. Or maybe I should think about how this person's name might be relevant to some feature of their face or how this person is related to somebody I know. And the problem is that in people with depression, autoimmune problems like multiple sclerosis or probably even long COVID, issues like schizophrenia, what we can see is that the prefrontal cortex is really not functioning optimally. And even in healthy people, as we get older, our prefrontal cortex isn't functioning so well. And so we have trouble remembering, but that trouble that we have remembering is not because we can't form memories, but it's rather because we can't focus on the information that's relevant to us.
So this leads us to a next topic that appears at multiple places in the book, the connection between memory and attention. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yes. Well, we know that people's ability to focus attention is very limited. So even though we might think that we're taking in all the information around us, in fact, we're only able to get information about a small fraction of what we're taking in any given time. And our brains are optimized that way. Rather than trying to take in everything, the brain is really optimized for taking in high quality information about a small number of things in our world. So why this is important is because if you don't pay attention to something, your ability to remember it later on is going to be very poor. And if we pay attention to the wrong things, our memory is also going to be very poor. So really, a major obstacle that we have with memory is that we have to focus attention on what is going to make this moment memorable. And what I mean by that is there are certain aspects of our experiences that make this moment in time unique. It might be the temperature of the room. It might be the sights of your face or the way that I'm, the sounds that are going on in the background. And it's those moments that, if we pay attention to them, give us a very rich, distinctive memory. And as I talk about in the book, much of why we forget is because memories compete with each other. And if you have a lot of memories that are very similar to each other, it can be very hard to find the information you're looking for. The analogy I give is much like if I have a desk and my desk is cluttered with a whole bunch of white papers on it. Then if I'm trying to find one particular paper, I'll never find it because there's so many other papers that look just like it. But if I'm trying to look for a paper that's pink amidst this big desk of white papers, the pink one is going to stand out and I'll find it really easily. And memory is the same way, really. It's that if you have a memory that's very distinctive from everything else that you've experienced, it's going to be much easier. But you have to attend to those features that are really distinctive. And those features are often the sights, the sounds, and the smells that make this moment important and unique. And we often don't take the time to do that. We sit in our heads or we stay in our devices and we don't pay attention to the world.
You mentioned this misconception that the more you can remember and the more details you can recall, the better. But you mentioned that actually it matters more what you can remember. And it's not the amount that makes the difference.
That's right. I think it's very tempting to say, oh, I should be able to remember everything. But what I like to tell people is, okay, well, let's say if I walked into your house and you had everything neatly organized and you had a lot of open space, if I were to come into your house and say, this looks terrible, you're wasting all of the space, why don't you just fill this entire room with boxes and stuff? And why are you throwing things away when you can save them and hold on to them and hoard them, right? You'd look at me like I was crazy. But I think this is the attitude that people have about memories, that we should be hoarding memories and having just this completely jam-packed brain full of all of this information that we don't need and don't want. And so I think evolution designed our brains to be much more selective, because it allows us to take the information that's important, find it, and use it when we need it.
This also brings us to a distinction about the various phases of memory research, that at the very beginning with Ebbinghaus, memory research was about remembering information. And later, it also started to focus on episodic memories. How did that transition happen?
It was controversial at the time, and this idea is controversial now. So I think for a long time, you mentioned Ebbinghaus, and so he was the first researcher to scientifically study memory. And Ebbinghaus and a number of early memory researchers just basically thought of memory as any kind of association. Anything that happens to be associated with each other, you just say, okay, that's memory. And one of Endel Tulving's big contributions was to say, Endel Tulving was a scientist who studied memory. And in his early work, he came to believe that, in fact, memories are more complicated than that, and that there are differences between different kinds of memories. And so he proposed this idea that there's a difference between what he called semantic memory, what he called episodic memory. So semantic memory would be our knowledge about the world. And episodic memory is our memory for particular events that we've experienced, even if it's just once. So, for example, you might remember have knowledge about Berlin and the city of Berlin in Germany and be able to pull up all sorts of factoids based on things that you've learned. But that conscious experience and the way the computations that happen in the brain to pull up that knowledge are different than what you need to be able to remember a specific experience that you've had in Berlin. Particular time that you went to a place and had you went to a museum or a cafe or something that will bring you back to a unique place and time. And so you can have very clear knowledge about Berlin, and you can have at the same time specific experiences that you've had in Berlin. Those are very different kinds of memories. And so it took a long time for Endel's idea to take hold. And really, one of the things that happened was people started to look at people with particular kinds of brain damage. And it became clear that people with damage to an area called the hippocampus could sometimes build new semantic memories, even though they didn't have episodic memory, that their episodic memory is blown up. And likewise, using fMRI, myself and a whole lot of other researchers have shown that when people retrieve, when they recall an episodic memory, or even when they're forming, the brain is forming a new episodic memory, then you see that activity in the hippocampus is related to what people will remember. But it's not the case for semantic memory. It seems to be especially important for episodic memory. And so this has been part of the shift that we've seen in our field. And one of the things that Tulving proposed that's especially interesting is that we use episodic memory to imagine the future. And Endel even found a patient who had this big episodic memory deficit, but he also couldn't imagine his future. And other people have since found other patients like that. So episodic memory seems to be this very unique, special system that we have that allows us to travel through time. And Endel even called it mental time travel. This idea of being able to go back into the past and go into the future completely in your own mind. And I initially thought this is crazy, but the more science we did on the topic, the more it became clear that he was right. And I think in some sense, we've all had this experience where you smell something, or you're in a place that you haven't been to in years, or you hear a song on the radio, And it gives you this palpable feeling of being in the past. And so that was, I think, scientifically being able to show that those feelings that we have are very real and based on a particular kind of a memory system in the brain. That's been, I think, a very exciting breakthrough that's been made in the field.
In the book, you mentioned a very specific example for this where that context doesn't just influence your memories, but even your language skills when you happen to be in India. Can you tell this example?
One of the things that I noticed was places can be very powerful in helping us cue memories for the past. And so when I was a child, we would travel to India maybe once every 4 years to visit relatives. And we'd stay there for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks and then come back. And one of the things that I found was when I was living in the U.S., I was in a little mental compartment where I couldn't remember any of my experiences in India too well. But then when I would get off the plane into India again, I would have this feeling of these memories that were just more accessible to me. And it really opened my eyes to the importance of what we call context, the surroundings that we're in that become a key part of the memory. So one of the things about being in India that's so unique is that the colors, the smells, even the feeling of the air, the sounds are all very unique. And so being in that environment made it easier for me to pull up all of this information that I had learned in that environment, including even language words, for instance, that I might have learned in that environment. And so that really opened up my eyes to how important context can be in helping us retrieve information.
You have mentioned these fMRI studies showing the similarities between memory and imagination. Can you tell us a bit more about your research? What kind of memory-related topics are you working on now, and how has it evolved over time?
Well, I have studied episodic memory for most of my career. I studied other forms of memory too, but mostly episodic memory. And a big part of my research was focused on the importance of context and being able to think about how memories are organized according to when they happened, where they happened, and all of this information in the background, and how our brain manages to create this background for which we lay down these episodic memories. And eventually, I've moved beyond that to think about not just single brain regions and how these brain regions might encode context, but to thinking about networks in the brain, regions that work together, and how these regions work together to store memories. And then later on, I started to think more about not looking at memories for little details like names or being able to remember a picture that someone has seen, but rather remembering a whole event, like something like a movie that you've seen over the course of 2 hours. And one of our big findings from this, and other people too have shown this recently, is that when people watch a movie or when they see some kind of, they listen to a story, for instance, or even if you're listening to music, what you find is the brain seems to encode new episodic memories very few times. So it's not like the brain is encoding every moment of a song or a movie into memory, but rather it's only grabbing a few bits and pieces of that movie. And then we use a lot of our semantic memory, our knowledge, or schemas to fill in the blanks and make that story up. So that's been where we're going now, is really to understand how does the brain put together these little specifics and then help us generate a story for something that happened over the course of an hour. Because something that you see in neural activity, we tend to focus on things that happen within a few seconds. But when we remember events from our lives, they take several minutes. And so it's a much bigger picture that we can open up. And so this is what we're trying to explore through fMRI, through recordings of electrical activity in the brain, and through computer models that allow us to simulate how all of these processes might work.
Then you say that they are recording or forming new episodic memories very few times during such an event. How few is that? So what? So let's say I am listening to a 90 minutes long lecture, or I am watching a movie which is 90 minutes long. How many episodic memories can I expect?
Well, this is controversial, and we don't know the answer to that. But what we seem to, one of the findings that I think we're very moved by is that, let's say if you're watching a 90-minute movie, over the course of that movie, people tend to break up that movie into a series of events. So you might have scene number one, you find that there's a dead body that's discovered. And then scene number two, a detective walks into the scene, and then they start making notes. And then the next scene is the detective starts asking the witnesses questions about what's happening, what they were doing during the time of the murder. And so what you can see in the brain is that during any one event, the areas of the brain that are important for episodic memory, like the hippocampus, tend to be very silent. And then during these moments where you transition from one event to the next, like you go from seeing the body to then the detective walking into the scene and taking notes, those moments where we switch from one event to another, we call those event boundaries. And it's at these event boundaries, the boundary between one event and the next, where we see the most memory-related activity taking place. And so if you have a movie that people might say, yeah, this is a 90-minute movie, but I can tell you basically about, I can summarize it in 20 events, then you might have 20 linked episodic memories out of that one movie.
Does this also indicate that the number of these transitions or even the boundaries influences how many memories a person is going to have about this event?
That's right. That's exactly right. And so that's what we're really interested in studying now, is how people generate a mental understanding of an event, and to figure out what happens at these event boundaries that makes people change their understanding of what's happening.
In the book, you mentioned that your research on memory also again and again influences your activity as a teacher, and especially when teaching undergraduate courses. What do you think? How does this information about transitions and event boundaries influence, for example, lecture setup?
Well, that's a good question. I've never really thought about it, to be honest, how I could use that in my teaching. I mean, I definitely teach the students about event boundaries. But I think the biggest thing that people could do in thinking about event boundaries is, one of the facts that we know is that when we have event boundaries happen in our head, it becomes harder to remember things that happened before the event boundary. And what I mean by that is, we just take a classic example of, I leave my room and I walk into the kitchen. And when I get to the kitchen, I might say, hey, what am I doing here? Why did I decide to go to the kitchen? And the reason is that every time I leave the room and go into another room, my mental context changes. And I say, and my brain is telling me one event has ended and another has begun. And so even though I've traveled a very short distance, and it was not long ago when I just started walking towards my kitchen, mentally, I have to travel back very far from one event back to the previous event. I have to jump over that event boundary to get back to my memory of why I went into the kitchen in the first place. And so what you see when people are trying to pay attention to a lecture, they'll often be distracted by things that are going on their phone, for instance, and they might get alerts on their phone. And what I find is that when that happens, people have a little event boundary in their head. If I switch from paying attention to this lecture to all of a sudden looking at my phone, and every time I do that, I create a new event boundary. So instead of having one very rich memory of this topic in the lecture, I have a whole lot of fragmented, blurry memories of switching back and forth between the lecture and the phone. And so this is something that I really try to impress upon my students, is how important it is to minimize those kinds of distractions that can make it hard for us to keep up and pay attention to what's going on.
In the book, you also mention another example where in January 2021, during the pandemic and online education, you decided to change the grading system for your undergraduate course. And I found this very, very insightful. So can you perhaps share it?
Yeah. So one of the things that I decided during the pandemic was that it became very hard to use tests to grade people, because once people were attending classes remotely, you couldn't guarantee that they weren't cheating. It was just very, very hard. And then again, we had another problem, which is the students weren't very engaged. They weren't paying attention. And so what I started to do was give people all sorts of quizzes and really giving people more quizzes to keep them engaged in the material. But the act of testing, I knew from memory research, would also enhance people's memories for the information that they're trying to learn. And so I really focused my efforts with teaching on using tests as a learning tool rather than using tests as a way to measure how good people are.
That's a very interesting distinction. And how was the result of this experiment? What kind of feedback did you get?
Well, I was very surprised by this because students never seem to enjoy doing tests. They never enjoy classes. And what I found, or they never enjoy being graded. But what I found was when we were using tests as a learning tool, that is, I was saying, asking people to do to answer questions and then basically say, okay, well, here's the answer and I'm going to retest you on this later. People were telling me that they actually really appreciated the tests, that they felt like it helped them learn the material better, it helped them focus, and it gave them some kind of a sense of being prepared for their real exams when they would get them. And so I really found that, in fact, counterintuitively, rather than stressing people out, these tests turned out to be something that gave people a lot of comfort because they were learning more from the process.
That's a very important distinction, that tests which don't stress the students, but instead make them feel that they are learning. And what were the features of these tests that enabled this switch?
Well, we proposed, and this is a theory, but we proposed that part of what tests do is they allow us to see the weaknesses in our memory. And I mean that in two ways. One is, as I mentioned before, people tend to be overconfident in how much they're going to remember. And people think that they'll remember more than they really will. And so when you get tested and you can't pull up something that you thought you should remember, now it makes you refocus and reorient yourself towards trying to memorize this thing more effectively. Whereas if I just studied the same material over and over, I wouldn't realize that I hadn't memorized it as well. Now, beyond that, we think that there's a role for testing because what it does is it allows us to recall something, but our recollections are never 100% accurate or perfect. Sometimes you might remember something slowly, sometimes you might really struggle, and sometimes you might not remember anything at all. But then the nice thing is that when this happens, we believe that the brain will be able to take the feedback that you get when you say, hey, this is the right answer, this is the answer you're looking for, that essentially the brain can use that feedback to optimize the memories and to basically strengthen the components of the memory that are very useful and throw out the components of the memory that are not so useful. And this is why we think you can actually get improvements in memory if you test people even before they've ever learned the answer, because that testing allows the brain to generate an answer. And then when you give the real answer, the wrong answers can be suppressed and the right answers can be pumped up and brought up. So later on, that reduces the competition that you'd see in memory.
That brings us back a bit to a topic at the beginning of the conversation, that recording actively alters the memory. Is this what we can observe here?
That's right. That's right. So this is an example of what we've called error-driven learning. And the idea is that we never remember something perfectly, but once we try to remember it and then we get feedback, that act of remembering it can change the memory. And in the case of testing, we can strengthen the memory that we're trying to recall later on. But on the other hand, testing can also sometimes, or trying to recall a memory can lead it to go in a bad direction. So for instance, if I'm trying to recall something from the past, but then I have some wrong information that I'm keeping in my head when I remember this thing from the past, the memory can be updated in ways that make it more inaccurate and add a bunch of errors to the memory later on. And that's why sometimes people will have these very old memories that they're very sure of what happened, but in fact, they can often be quite inaccurate because they sort of embellish the story. And then when they embellish the story, those little bits of mistakes will go back into the memory and be incorporated into your original memory for what happened.
So we can almost say that later on, they won't just remember the event, but they will remember the story or painting of the previous analogy, which they created based on the memory.
Yeah, that's right.
That's interesting. I would like to circle back a bit to what you said about testing before even learning the material. Is it a move to influence the attention of the learner?
I think attention is part of it, but we also think that there's a part of it which comes from the fact that you are giving the brain the opportunity to pull out the memory and to open up the weaknesses in the memory trace. And you can even see this in computer models that essentially, like if you look at information in computer models like ChatGPT, what you find is those models learn best if rather than having it just memorize everything over and over again, you just expose the memory that's in the model and then you tweak the model to do a better job of pulling up the right memory. So by fixing what's wrong, you do better than trying to just have it memorize over and over again. But attention is also a part of it too.
And you have also mentioned an important point that all this testing can be very stressful and can pull negative emotions. Are there some strategies or did you use for these specific quizzes? For the undergraduate course, some strategies which made the experience less stressful for the students?
That's a good question. To be honest, no. I can't remember using any strategies. I guess the biggest thing I did was I made it pretty clear that it was okay to do badly on the test. I think that was the biggest thing, was I said, look, you can drop the worst four quizzes from your grade. So even if you don't get everything right, don't worry about it. And then I said, if you, the same questions I'm giving you in the quiz, I'll use again later on the midterm exam. And so even if you get it wrong now, that's okay because you can still get it right later on. And I think that gave people some reduction in their stress because they didn't feel like every quiz they were getting was some kind of a high pressure situation.
Yes, that actually sounds like such a strategy. And in the book, you also mention about I mentioned a project of your own that you started to learn surfing. How is learning some movement, motor movement, different from learning information?
Well, there's definitely a difference in the sense that people who have brain damage that affects your episodic memory can still learn new physical skills. So somebody who had, say, damage to the hippocampus, which is a brain area that's essential for episodic memory, they won't be able to form new episodic memories. And yet they could still learn new skills. So you might theoretically put them on a surfboard and they could learn surfing, but each time they would do it, they might not remember that they had previously done it before. So what that tells us is that some of this learning how to do things is independent of our ability to remember what happened. But what we've also learned is that there does seem to be some interaction where early on it helps to have episodic memory so that you can learn faster. And it's really after you've had some practice that it's better to let go of episodic memory. When you get on a surfboard, you don't want to remember the last time I was on a surfboard. But what I can tell you is in the beginning, I was desperately relying on episodic memory to remember what my teacher would tell me. And you know, you're sitting on a board, you're trying to study the waves and figure out which wave you should be catching. And that's definitely dependent on episodic memory.
How much is it dependent on episodic memory and how much on semantic memory?
Probably all of the above. I think this is the challenge in memory research is I can do experiments to pull all of these different kinds of memory apart. But in the real world, everything is somewhat connected. And it's very hard, in fact, to separate semantic and episodic and memory and skill learning because they all work together. I mean, for instance, take an example of driving in a new city. Well, there's some skill involved in that, but then there's also memorizing the locations of things. And then there's your general knowledge of the way cities work and the layout of cities. And all of that comes together when you're trying to like form a mental map of a new place.
Yes, it's true. And it's interesting that you bring up such an example as driving, where the skill part is perhaps not that challenging, but if you are put in a new context, then it can suddenly become a challenge. But there are some recent advances or recent open questions in memory research that you find the most intriguing.
Well, I would say that right now, there's two questions that I find fascinating. One question is how people differ in their memory abilities. That is something that we know very little about, but we're learning that people differ quite a bit. There are some people who seem to have an inability to visualize things that they remember. And there's other people who have an incredible detail in the amount of things that they remember. And so this is just one characteristic, but there seem to be many other ways in which people differ. But we don't really know much about it. We don't know how much variability there is. We don't know why people differ if they do. And we don't know what the brain mechanisms are that make one person remember differently from another. So I think that's a very interesting topic. I think another interesting topic relates to how we can use computer models to get better insights into what's happening in the brain. And one of the things that I've really become attuned to through doing this work is that nothing comes for free when you're designing a machine or when you're designing a brain. If you optimize a brain for learning a massive amount of information, you find that learning happens very slowly. But if you optimize a brain for learning very quickly, then you don't necessarily keep all this information, because what can happen is that you can learning new information leads you to forget old information. And so once you start putting all these little insights together, you get a picture of how the brain works and why we need episodic memory to allow us to learn quickly and semantic memory to allow us to build the knowledge that we need to navigate this world.
Would you distinguish them like this, that episodic memory is what happens quickly but is easier to forget, and semantic memory is for the more information for longer term?
I would say mostly yes, that episodic memory should be something that you can form very quickly, because many episodes only happen once. This conversation is only going to happen once. You know, this moment that I've snapped my fingers is already gone. It happened once. And so if I'm going to remember any of these things, I have to be able to form memories very quickly. Semantic memory, on the other hand, takes a long time to develop, because people really need to get experience with a concept in many different ways and explore the meaning of these concepts in different contexts and be able to remember, let's say, or just to be able to express that knowledge that we have in many situations. And so that's thought to be a form of slow learning.
Hmm. Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. I wouldn't have thought about it that way. What are you working on right now?
Well, we're doing right now, one of the topics that we're interested in is trying to understand how people form mental maps of the world around us. And so we've used this example before, but if I'm walking in a new city, let's say if I'm traveling through Europe and I walk around a city that I've never been to, I can gradually form a mental map where I might be walking around and lost, and all of a sudden I see a big church, and then all of a sudden it pulls up my memory for where everything is around me. And so we're using a combination of computer models. We're going to be using virtual reality techniques and other advanced approaches to be able to understand how people can get a memory for where they are in the world, and to be able to imagine and plan how to go from point A to point B.
That sounds very interesting. What kind of insight from this research or any other area would motivate you to write a second edition of this book?
Well, I find that probably advances that are going to happen in the science will probably lead me to question some of the things I said in the book. I mean, if our field is successful, there's almost certainly things that I'll have to change, because the science is constantly evolving and our understanding of how things work changes as a result of the new science that comes in. And so one of the things that's both scary and exciting is that as we learn more and more and more, I'll have to keep writing new editions of the book to update it and give people the latest view of what's going on.
Thank you. And thanks so much also for this conversation. And I will be very happy to talk to you about the second edition as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for this interview.